This is Jim Engster, and our guest to begin the show today is Dr. Rainer Weiss. He's a professor emeritus at MIT. Previously, Professor Weiss served as an assistant physics professor at Tufts University and has been an adjunct professor at LSU since 2001. He is a winner of the 2017 Nobel Prize in Physics. It was awarded last week to three pioneers at the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, which announced last year the world's first direct detection of gravitational waves. On September 14th of 2015, LIGO's observatories in Livingston Parish and in Hanford, Washington, detected tiny ripples in the fabric of space-time caused by the merger of two massive black holes about 1.3 billion years ago. And good morning to you, and congratulations, Dr. Rainer Weiss.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, it's a pleasure to talk with you, and you're an institution at MIT, a legend, and for good reason. But even though you've had all these accolades in your long career, there's nothing quite like the Nobel Prize, is there?
No, it's quite something. But, you know, I'm an old guy. I'm 85, so, you know, I've been hanging on for many, many years. So, okay.
Well, we'll talk about your backstory. This is a fascinating gentleman we're speaking with. But how did you end up at LSU?
Well, that's a very important story, and I'm glad you asked that question. It actually comes about because LSU, in a time when very, very few people in the world, none of the universities really in the United States except a very few of them, were thinking about this field of gravitational wave physics and gravitational wave astronomy. And I think I don't know exactly the date it was, but in the mid-80s of the last century, they hired a guy named Warren Johnson. And then he hired a guy named William Hamilton. And they were people who were doing this kind of work at LSU with a different technique. I won't go into that. It was a great big bar and a big metal bar, aluminum bar. And they had one of the world's best bars sitting there, right there in Baton Rouge. And they were trying very hard to see gravitational waves. And they set pretty good limits, but they didn't see any. But that's how it all started. And that has nothing to do with LIGO and me. They were there way before us. And then when LIGO became an idea that looked like it was looking for a place to be done, they made a big effort to try to get LIGO to come to Louisiana, and they succeeded. And they were the ones who discovered that site in Livingston, and they were strong advocates for the whole new technique. And they, in fact, William Hamilton really sort of retired, but Warren became part of the team that built up LIGO in Louisiana. And so it's a long history. It's way before LIGO. And I think the whole state ought to be thankful to them for bringing this thing to Louisiana, because it turned out to be moderately successful, otherwise I wouldn't be with you.
Well, this discovery, Dr. Weiss, it confirmed a major prediction of Albert Einstein's 1915 general theory of relativity. And does it open a new window into the cosmos?
Well, that's certainly what it did. And don't mind me if I correct you, but I'm a little bit of a pedant, okay? But there was actually hints of this before LIGO. I mean, pretty good hints. And that was done by people doing radio astronomy. And they had found a pair of stars, what called neutron stars. These are stars that are as heavy as our sun, but about the size of Baton Rouge. So, I mean, they're enormously dense. And a little teaspoon of it will weigh millions of tons. It's an amazing object. And they found two of these, and when they were very carefully mapping them with looking at the pulses that were coming from these two, from one of the stars, which happened to be a pulsar, they discovered in the process of trying to solve for the motions of these objects that they had to include gravitational waves as a way of understanding their motion. And so back in, 2000, or in the 1900s, 1990s, they won the Nobel Prize for that system, and along with it, sort of the very first hint, what we'll call the indirect detection of gravitational waves. But the direct detection, which is what was done at Livingston and also in Washington, as you point out, is not just a confirmation of Einstein, but it's really a couple of other things. It attests to that, you know, you and I, people, can make a device that can measure these very, very delicate distortions of space and time. And then those measurements can be used, just as you indicate, to open a new field of astronomy, a different kind entirely. than what we have opened with the kinds of things that telescopes see, the normal telescopes. That's called electromagnetic astronomy because it uses electromagnetic waves for you to communicate with that distant system. Here we're using something which is completely different. The electromagnetic waves come from a system of when a thing has charges in it, you know, charges, and those charges accelerate. That's the source of those waves. Whereas the things that we see are the source of those is accelerating mass, and that has a profound difference in terms of what information you might get from a system that you know. I'll give you an example. For example, we couldn't see these black holes directly. They still can't see them. I wish they could. Optical telescopes have looked in the regions where we saw this, but they didn't see anything yet. Maybe eventually, if we pinpoint the place better, people will see exactly what's going on there. But the reason we saw them at all, or was able to observe them or measure signals from them, is because they were massive, and they radiated these gravitational waves. And this way of looking at something that you knew about, but you didn't know all about, is something called multi-messenger astronomy. In other words, that you have now a completely other way of looking at some things you know about. And one of the things that will be announced more on October 16th, I won't go into it here, but that's just to tease your listeners. Another thing is someday we hope to see what goes on deep inside of an explosion of a star called a supernova. And then we will really find out what goes on inside of it, because these gravitational waves, they don't give a damn about what they go through. They go right through everything. They go through all the matter between them. And a light doesn't do that. Light gets stopped by atoms and molecules that are in the way. Gravitational waves are just impervious to everything. They just move right through. So you can look deep into things you've never seen before. Or rather, you can see things which you've never seen before deep inside of things. On the other hand, what we're really hoping for, and that's sort of the deepest answer to your question, is the business of that now with a new window like this and with a new way of looking at things, you might find things that nobody's ever seen by another method. And that's a great hope, and I fully expect it will happen.
What exactly happened on September 14th, 2015, that just came out of seemingly nowhere? Obviously, it was somewhere, but what happened on that day that was different than all the other days?
Well, what was different about it is that the instrument saw something, okay? We had been running, I mean, we've been in Louisiana since the end of the 90s building this instrument. And in fact, LSU and has been deep in all of these processes. We ran an initial instrument, which was an instrument which was not as sensitive as the one that made the discovery, but was a very important instrument to operate. We ran that in Louisiana and in Washington for something like 7 years, six years. And we saw what I would call a very good, clean nothing. In other words, sometimes when you see nothing, it's bad. But this time we saw nothing, but we understood why we saw nothing. We understood the instrument well enough. And we just could declare that we didn't see anything, and there were no gravitational waves stronger than a certain magnitude. And luckily, we had ideas, and the National Science Foundation, which is the organization that funded this, which is in Washington, and everybody has paid to have us do this, which is I'm very thankful for. They continued us by allowing us to put another instrument in the same envelope, a better instrument that was, you know, which had more sensitivity. And with the changes that were made, almost very close to the beginning of trying to run with that instrument after it was installed, we saw this thing that now you described really in the beginning of the program. Namely, we saw something which people had thought about, which is that we knew about black holes. People had seen black holes in other settings. People doing X-ray astronomy had seen black holes. I won't go into how that happens unless you ask, but we knew that black holes existed, which was already a pretty important thing because Einstein didn't think they would exist. And many, many people here at MIT, when I was a kid, didn't believe in them either because it's a very strange thing, phenomena. This things go crazy in the theory, it looks like.
Well, you brought it up. How did the conventional wisdom change on black holes?
Well, it did because people began to find these. That was the big thing. I think the thing that made the transition was indeed the X-ray astronomers. I mean, now you're asking me. I might as well tell you. I mean, what happened is they began to see, there's another one of these wonderful examples of a new way of looking at the universe. This happened to be an electromagnetic way of looking at the universe. Instead of looking with your eyes, you looked with instruments, and you looked at X-rays that came out of some system. And they noticed that the X-rays came out of a system in many places in our own galaxy where they knew They could see with their optical telescopes, they could see one object. And they could, by looking at that object, they could see that it was moving around something else, but they couldn't see the thing it was moving around. And so they studied that, and they began to realize that the mass of that thing it was going around was bigger than anything they would have expected for a neutron star, which is these stars we talked a little about earlier. And so they said, look, we can't see the thing. It's that close to the ordinary star we know and love. It has to be a black hole. And they had a hell of a time convincing everybody about that. But eventually they won because it was the simplest explanation of that phenomenon. And so we knew that single black holes, and people had accepted that certainly by the time LIGO was being built. Most people, not everybody, but most people.
All right,
but
hold
the
tight.
New thing.
Hold tight. We do have to take a break, but we will return and spend another segment with Nobel Prize winner Dr. Rainer Weiss from MIT and LSU. We're back after this pause on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to Talk Louisiana, and we're visiting with Nobel Prize winner Dr. Ray Weiss of MIT and LSU. He's been teaching at LSU since 2001, and this man is recognized around the world for his scientific success and has won, along with two others, the 2017 Nobel Prize, and it's all because of a project that is rooted deep in the heart of Livingston Parish, and you were on the ground floor. LSU, by the way, has many contributors to the LIGO Science Collaboration, and this is something that I don't think we've probably recognized as much as we should in our community. This is heady stuff around the world, and much of it is based right here in our backyard, Dr. Weiss.
Yeah, well, let me just encourage you to make it a little better known, because I'm going to give you some names of people that people ought to talk to who are right at LSU. In particular, there's really a world-class scientific research group at LSU now, operating and deeply involved with doing the data analysis and doing the operations of this project. I mean, in other words, they're there out there in Livingston every day helping make that apparatus run. And so the group that I'm talking about is Joe Giami, who runs that site. He's a professor at LSU. And Gabriela Gonzalez, who is also a professor in that group. And then a young professor named Thomas Corbett, who is working on new advanced ideas that might eventually be used in that device. And Jorge Pullen, who is a theorist, a famous theorist in gravity, who happens to be at LSU, too. So you've got one of the most substantial groups in the country on this in this field. So you ought to be proud of it. And anyway, let me go back to what I was telling you earlier, namely about you asked me why what was so special about this event that was seen in 2015. And I was telling you about black holes a little. And let me just finish that thought. So and what was new that came out of that discovery that, back in 2015, and what was new about it was not that black holes were never seen before. What was never seen before was two black holes together, that there were two black holes within reach of each other. That was new. We couldn't predict that. We didn't know that. In fact, in our early planning of LIGO, we were not sure we could ever detect black holes. Alone, it's kind of hard to do, but when they go around each other, they dance around each other, they're accelerating. That means that they radiate gravitational waves. And what we did indeed see is these two black holes, and they're big ones. They're 30 solar masses of sort of about each one. I mean, I'm approximating. And they go around each other, and they dance around each other, and then they get closer and closer and closer, and then they smash into each other. And all of this is registered in the gravitational waves, and when they smash into each other, they make a new black hole. That's not quite twice as heavy as the two black holes separately, because a good about something like 5% of the radiation, 5% of the energy gets radiated away. And that is so powerful. It was about the most powerful explosion in the universe. It lit up the universe in gravitational waves, much more powerful than all the light that the whole universe emits at any one moment. It really was quite a spectacular event.
I mentioned that this probably happened 1.3 billion years ago. How do we arrive at that figure?
Okay, well, that's thank you for that question. That's an interesting question and a good one. You arrive at that because there's a very good theory of gravity that was developed by Albert Einstein. We have calibrated our instruments. We know how sensitive they are. That's part of the task of running such a device. So we know exactly how much of a strength of gravitational wave pushes our masses around in that instrument that's out in Livingston. And knowing that, and knowing what, once having identified by the motions of that system what it is, knowing the masses of it, you can calculate what must be the distance to it, because Einstein's theory gives you the way of doing that. In other words, Einstein's theory says it tells you how the signal or the gravitational waves will get smaller in the measurement the strain measurement will get smaller as the wave progresses from that source to your detector. And so by knowing the masses from just the signals themselves, knowing our sensitivity of the detector, we have a pretty good idea using Einstein's theory, just plugging away, putting in numbers into it, where it is, the distance it's away. Now, we don't know it exactly. We have to make some models. But look, to what you're saying, sort of 1 billion light years away is a pretty good guess. And we'll, as we get more of these, we're finding, in fact, we've seen more of them. Many of them live out there, the ones that we're seeing.
Well, the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory in Livingston played a critical role in this discovery.
Central role. God damn it, say it right. It was absolutely not more than it. We couldn't have been done without it. You said critical. It's the right word. But, you know, we couldn't have done it without Louisiana. Come on.
Well, the odds of this happening would seem to be about as astronomical as the odds of a young man born in Berlin ending up in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and winning the Nobel Prize. You've got quite a story yourself, Dr. Rainer Weiss. How did all this happen for you?
Well, that's a very long story, and let's not make too much of it. I was always interested in science as a kid, and luckily I went to a good college, MIT, and I flunked out because I had a love affair. That's another problem, but and then what happened is I got a job with a guy who, and every one of us needs a guy like this. I worked with a guy named Gerald Zacharias, and I worked in his lab, and he hardly knew me when he hired me. In fact, his technicians hired me, and I stayed in his lab as a card-carrying union member for a while before I went back to school, and I worked with him, and the guy, we got to know each other very well. And that guy said, you know, you're not as stupid as you look. And he helped me out enormously. So that's the real basis of the whole story. Look, I want to tell you one other thing, which you haven't asked me, but I want, before this is over, to tell you something else that's at Livingston, which everybody ought to know about. Do you mind if I do that?
No, go ahead.
Okay. They have a really remarkable facility out there, which has benefited your state, the whole state, and has really done some important, I think, I'm of all the things that LIGO has done, that's one of the most things that certainly I'm personally most proud of. Not that I had any... I didn't build it, but the idea was Barry Barish's idea and Michael Zucker's idea and a lot of other people at Southern University had part of this. And what it is, it's a remarkable science museum that's out there, but it's more than a museum. It's right on the site. It's open to people from the outside on special days. You have to just look on your website and find out when it's open. It's usually on a Saturday. And they do two functions. They first of all have a wonderful museum, a lot of elegant experiments which kids and even adults can run. Maybe more likely the kids. Yeah, the adults are not as skilled as the kids often. And they show a lot of the things that are inside the apparatus. And you can play with things, and it gives you a better understanding of what's going on inside that facility that's right there. But the other function it has is it brings students there. People come in school buses from different schools all over Louisiana. It's not just Livingston Parish. And the kids, while the kids are playing with the instruments and the various things that are really fun to do, the teachers are learning all about this, and they take back to their school little samples of these things, and they can build them at their own schools. And so, consequently, we're slowly but surely filling up Livingston as best as Louisiana as best as we can with the ideas and the concepts that are associated with LIGO. And I think when I go there a lot. Lately, I've not been there that much because of all this hoopla, but I love to go in there secretly and watch what goes on. The kids are wonderful, and the teachers, as they learn, it just opens up much more than just the universe. It opens up real ideas into the way science is done. So I'm extremely pleased with that facility, and it ought to be better known by everybody in the state.
Well, at 85, you have survived Nazi Germany. You've lived through some world conflicts, and you've been on the forefront of this for most of your career, if not all of it. Is this the culmination of your life's work?
Oh, my gosh. You make it sound so dramatic. Come on.
Well, it is.
Let me say it the way I like to, okay? And that'll end it. I'll tell you something. People make it sound like such an ordeal. You know, 40 years, you're doing all this. Oh, my God, never detecting gravitation. That was never the way we viewed it, all of us who worked on this. What it is, you work on something today, like a better circuit or a mechanical gizmo that you made that goes in it, And you get a lot of kick out of what you did. If it doesn't work, you fix it the next day, and you keep at it. And the thing is, every day is if it isn't fun, you won't do it. And the other part of it is that we were very lucky in this project to have people we all liked each other. So it was a pleasure to work with the people all over the project. Caltech, MIT, and both at both sites, Livingston and Washington, we have a team of people who are just wonderful to work with. So then every once in a while, yeah, maybe you saw something, and that gets the excitement. But that's not the reason we all did it, and we stayed with it. So don't. I know what you're saying. This is a wonderful end for it. It's maybe the beginning of a new field, which is even better. But the real thing is I wouldn't have done anything else in my life. Understand? I hope you understand that.
Yeah. Well, it's been quite a voyage for you, and it continues.
Yeah. It does. You're right.
I'm being energized by your enthusiasm. You definitely love what you do.
Well, Dr.
Weiss, thank you. And thank you for coming to LSU. This is quite an honor, not only for MIT, but for Louisiana State University. And I appreciate the credit you've given to my alma mater.
You went there. Good for you. Okay. It's a great place. The music school is terrific, too, by the way.
It is indeed.
All right.
Thank you, Dr. Ray Weiss.
Yeah.
And congratulations.
Okay, thanks.
This is Jim Inkster. Our guest at this time is Tom Cohan. He's the co-director of the MIT Institute for Work and Employment Research, and his latest work is Shaping the Future of Work, a Handbook for Action and a New Social Contract. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Jim.
Well, you say that the book is a primer focused on creating an updated social contract for labor. How does this work?
Well, we used to have what we call a social contract. That is a good deal between employers and employees and their communities. Whereas the economy got better, so too did workers' wages and compensation moved up from the end of World War II till about 1980. Wages and productivity and economic growth moved up together. But then it flatlined on wages while productivity grew. So we've got to fix that. That's one of the reasons why we have so much anger and frustration and divisions in our society today. So it's time to put a new social contract in place.
You compare this to the New Deal. Is that an ambitious comparison?
Well, I think it's an accurate comparison. We didn't get that social contract after World War II out of just some iron law of economics. The New Deal in the 30s created a floor. Created minimum wages, Social Security, overtime protections, unemployment insurance, and most importantly, it provided workers with a means for engaging in collective bargaining. And so then as the economy recovered during World War II and afterwards, the workers were positioned to work with their employers to negotiate a fair share of the economic growth that they helped to achieve. So that's where we are. Right now, we need a fundamental change in our employment policies to catch up with the changing workforce and the changing nature of work and to lay a new foundation so that we can once again get the average worker sharing in economic growth.
Now, the stock market is, of course, at a historic high. Unemployment is at a historic low. So what is the problem?
Well, the problem is that wages haven't grown for the vast majority of the workforce in the last, really almost the last 30 years. But they're beginning to grow a little bit better now for those at the bottom. But that's because not only do we have tight labor markets, there's been pressure. The fight for a $15 an hour minimum wage is putting pressure on companies like Walmart and others to raise their wages. So people at the bottom now, because the labor market is tight and because there's been more protest, we're beginning to see some growth. But we've got to sustain that over a long period of time to catch up for lost time.
Now, the average wage varies wildly across the country. It's different in Boston than it is in Baton Rouge, and it's different in Los Angeles than it is in Cheyenne, Wyoming. So how can we have a national minimum wage that works?
Well, I'm not sure that we need a single national minimum wage for the reasons you mentioned. Clearly, the $7.25 an hour minimum wage isn't a living wage, even isn't a wage that will get you out of poverty in Louisiana or in Wisconsin or in Michigan or certainly not in the higher cost states around the country. So we've got to do something, and we could raise it, most economists now agree, to about $10 an hour, and it still would be equitable across the country. But then maybe beyond that, we should tie it to changes in the cost of living and to differences in living costs across the country. That would be one approach. I'm not for moving everything to $15 an hour now. That's too rapid. We'd lose too many jobs, and small businesses in particular would be hit too hard. And it doesn't make any sense to do it all in one step. But if we do it gradually over time, adjusted to changes in living costs in different parts of the country, as you said, I think that would be a step in the right direction.
The guest is Tom Cohan. He is the co-director of the MIT Institute for Work and Employment Research. His book is Shaping the Future of Work, A Handbook for Action and a New Social Contract. Now, the tax plan that is being debated in Congress and has passed one House, the U.S. House, it is one that some believe is a step in the right direction, and others say is a horrible misstep. How do you see it?
Well, I agree with those who think this is going in the wrong direction. Yes, we can cut corporate income taxes if there's a comparable deal with corporations that they will reinvest those funds in job-creating opportunities in the U.S., and if they will share the savings with their workforce. But there's no evidence from past cuts like this that that is going to happen in some natural way. So if we're going to cut corporate tax rates, and I'm not necessarily opposed to that, then let's put some conditions on it. Let's make sure that they are committed to helping invest in infrastructure, to rebuilding our economy, to investing those funds that they might bring back from across the world in job-creating opportunities here in the United States. And let's hold them accountable for sharing those gains with the workforce itself, rather than just paying higher dividends to their share owners or higher compensation to the CEO. If we just do what that bill says now, the people in the middle are the ones who are going to pay the price, and there's no guarantee that we will see the job creation that some believe might happen.
The president has advocated making our infrastructure better. There's no doubt we have a significant problem. Would that be a step in the right direction?
Oh, that would be a fantastic step in the right direction. I think everyone, regardless of political persuasion and economists and those of us who study the labor market, we all agree that that would be a good investment, a necessary investment. There's good long-range rates of return to economies that invest in infrastructure. We saw that with the interstate highway system in the 1950s. We saw that with the space race in the 1960s. We have terrible infrastructure problems, as you have in your part of the country and elsewhere. We also need to make sure we're investing in modern infrastructure like broadband, so that regions that don't have good internet service now can get into the digital age and rebuild their economies with the modern tools that are available. So, yes, infrastructure is absolutely a good investment.
Now, when President Clinton was discussing NAFTA 25 years ago, he did so at the risk of alienating many in his own party, including labor unions. And now we have a president from a different party with a different political persuasion and a much different ideology who is saying we need to tear it apart. What should we do regarding that trade agreement and others?
Well, NAFTA was poorly structured, and we did lose good manufacturing jobs to Mexico. But it's too late to try to turn back and just eliminate NAFTA. Yes, there's some things that can be done to adjust it, but by and large, right now, we have our economy so intertwined that if we eliminated NAFTA and repealed it, the auto industry in the United States would collapse because we have so much intertwined production with Mexico and Canada. So let's not be crazy about this. Let's make some adjustments, and let's move on to deal with the modern economy as we find it today. Now, what could we do with trade policies? Well, again, we can't just isolate the United States, but we should put stronger labor protections into trade agreements. The one that President Trump vetoed or decided not to follow up on, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Plan, what for the first time did have stronger labor protections in it. Now, there were still a lot of problems with that agreement, and so I'm not too upset that he didn't move forward with it, but I think it was a step in the right direction. We're in a modern world, a global world. We can't just isolate ourselves. We've got to make sure that we have strong relationships with our trading partners and go from there.
We're wrapping it up with Tom Cohan. His book is Shaping the Future of Work. He works from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Institute for Work and Employment Research. And as we look at the two major parties, is there anyone, and we're talking about the parties as a whole, speaking on behalf of the wide middle class in America, or are both parties neglecting many Americans?
Well, I think there's an increasing recognition that we've got to address middle America. Both candidates missed that opportunity. One used rhetoric that fooled the middle class, and the other simply just didn't communicate with people who are really hurting in our economy and our society. So we need politicians who are going to be honest with us, who are going to talk to workers and say, I understand why you are angry, and we're going to start to build new policies, but we're going to do it in a way that makes sense to you to provide job opportunities and new economic revitalization for you and for your families. There are people in the Democratic Party, there's even some people in the Republican Party who are talking about this, and I'm not so concerned about identifying the politician. Let's get the workforce out there telling all of the politicians that it's time to listen to us, listen directly, talk to us clearly, and then follow up, because we're going to hold you accountable.
Tom Cohan, it's been an honor to speak with you, and let's talk it again soon. It's been a pleasure.
Let's do that, Jim. I really appreciate it.
Take care.
Thanks.
Our next guest is Stephen Johnson. He grew up in Washington, D.C., completed his undergraduate degree at Brown University, has a graduate degree from Columbia University in English Literature. Stephen Johnson is the author of 9 books, largely on the intersection of science, technology, and personal experience. He has co-created 3 influential websites, the pioneering online magazine Feed, the Webby Award-winning community site Plastic.com, and most recently, the hyperlocal media site Outside In. He's a contributing editor to Wired and writes regularly for the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and the Financial Times. His latest work is a departure from some of his previous work. It's called Wonderland: How Play Made the Modern World. And we will talk with the remarkable Stephen Johnson after this brief timeout on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us. Our guest is Stephen Johnson, the best-selling author of 10 books, including How We Got to Now, Where Good Ideas Come From, The Invention of Air, The Ghost Map, and Everything Bad is Good for You. He is back with Wonderland, How Play Made the Modern World. How Play Made the Modern World. Do we, in this fast-paced world we're living in now, Stephen, do we take for granted something that is as basic as play?
I think we sometimes do. I mean, if you just look around, you know, your average town or city or your living room, and just think about how many experiences we have designed to entertain or amuse us that wouldn't have been accessible or affordable or even imaginable to someone 2 centuries ago. I mean, it's extraordinary, and that's a measure of progress on some level, is that we have more things that are fun in our lives, which is great, but Wonderland is trying to make this maybe a little bit more counterintuitive argument that, in addition to just kind of celebrating that history and understanding where these things came from, there's also a fascinating story here in terms of innovation, because so many inventions that ended up being very serious-minded and important and transformative ideas, both in science and technology, but also in politics and so on, actually have their roots in playful experiences, things that people were doing just for the fun of it, just for the amusement value, that ended up triggering these new ideas that changed the world. And that's really the macro argument of this book.
Well, you note that technological innovations such as early music boxes demonstrated advanced mechanical engineering, and player pianos paved the way for development of computer software. We've been down this road before.
Yeah, and the music boxes are really fascinating. And both music boxes and then these early, they call them automata, like early mechanical, almost robots that were created that could kind of behave in lifelike ways, many of which actually would play music as part of their kind of act. And, you know, you had these some of these date back 1,000 years. There was a great heyday of this kind of engineering in the 1700s where people would go and hang out in the salons of Paris and they would look at these little robotic creations. And at the time, they seemed to have no real utility, right? Nobody was doing anything other than, you know, chuckling with delight at seeing them. They weren't actually functional. But they actually had the seeds of ideas that then would be very important in the early days of the Industrial Revolution, but also prefigured a lot of what we're thinking about now in terms of robotics. But also, they were kind of programmable, right? You could create new instructions for these machines to behave in different ways, and you could encode those instructions, particularly with music. And if you wanted it to play a different song, you could create a different set of code, and you could put it in the machine, and it would play a different song. That's the beginning of programmable machines, right? That's the beginning of the difference between software and hardware that is so important in the modern world. But it started with what seemed to be just a toy.
The book is Wonderland from Stephen Johnson, How Play Made the Modern World. The New York Times Book Review puts it this way: a swashbuckling argument for the centrality of recreation to all of human history. The book is a house of wonders itself. You note that parks and zoos and coffee houses and taverns all have played a key role in revolutionizing society, and all of those entities are based somewhat on our commitment to having playtime.
Yeah, I mean, first off, thank you for quoting the Times Review, because that's the only time I've ever been called swashbuckling. I feel like I'm very proud of that. I may be the last, too. I don't know if anyone will have, if you knew me, you, that would not be the word.
Well, no, but that's a good one.
So, yeah, I mean, think about the role of taverns and pubs in American history, in the American Revolution. You know, the tavern was the place where it was the center of kind of the information network of the American Revolution. It was the place where common sense and the Declaration of Independence was read aloud. It was a place where people would gather and talk about potentially starting this rebellion. And so it was something crucial about a space that was kind of semi-public and semi-private, perhaps where the conversation was enhanced to some extent by the presence of alcohol, or maybe people's seditious feelings might be a little bit more freely expressed because they were drinking. And that really, you know, is an important part of our history. Like, maybe the American Revolution would have happened if taverns hadn't been invented, but almost certainly they would have required it would have required a different information network to get people together and to share the ideas that drove that case. So we have to conclude this is something we tend to not teach, you know,
right,
our sixth graders when we teach American history, for understandable reasons, but it's a part of the history for sure.
Stephen, you note that deep history can often be detected in the most banal of artifacts if you know where to look. And you note that one of the most derided items on a modern supermarket shelf, the humble Doritos chip, was originally introduced in 1964 as an exclusive treat for Disneyland visitors. What happened after that?
Well, the thing that is so fascinating about the Dorito, I actually kind of analyzed the ingredients off the package of a you know, recent Doritos package. And, you know, Doritos is kind of notorious for having a million different bizarre ingredients in there. There was an old onion parody that said Doritos celebrates its 1,000,000th ingredient. But if you break down all the kinds of foods and all the flavors that are in there in this simple little chip, it's actually an entire global system of food. If you figure out, like, well, this came from originally, you know, the tomato came from here and the potato came from here and the, you know, this spice came from here. And it's really, you know, some of it came from South America, some of it came from Northern Europe, some of it came from Asia. So an entire world of flavor and taste and food kind of converges on our tongue every time we have this. You know, we buy it for 99 cents at a highway stop, and yet there's a kind of a global network embedded in that chip. It's kind of crazy to think about it that way.
And you note that in the mid-1730s, John Houston was a down-on-his-luck cobbler when he decided to make a pilgrimage to Manhattan, setting up a shop in the big city, and then he opened a series of taverns. About 20,000 people lived in New York then, in Manhattan, and it was near the site of the World Trade Center, and it became a happening place.
Yeah, and like so many taverns then and since, it was a place where social conventions were being challenged and explored in a way that wasn't yet possible in kind of mainstream society. And so in Houston's Tavern, one of the things that about it was that it was really one of the only mixed-race bars that you'd have in New York, where African-Americans, a lot of freed slaves who'd come to New York, were sharing the space with whites, and sometimes with well-to-do whites who were kind of visiting to get a side, you know, kind of sense of how the other half lives. And it ended up being bound up. It's a whole crazy story. It ended up being bound up in this whole set of kind of riots, and then this harsh backlash, or a number of people were not only hung in public, but then their kind of bodies were left out in public as a kind of warning to other African Americans who were up. But the bar is at the center of it, and Houston, this kind of bar tavern owner, gets caught up in it, and it's clear from the trial that what people are offended by is that he's created this space where black and white people can hang out and have a drink together, that's really scandalous. And so if you look back at the history of bars, and this is true of the gay rights movement too, one of the first places where you see people challenging conventional assumptions about social identity is in bars. And bars are often at the kind of forefront of those civil rights, you know, sexual revolution, whatever you want to call it, kinds of changes in society.
Another place that has become synonymous in American culture is the shopping mall. And you go back to the suburbs of Detroit. I think it was in 1956, a guy named Victor Gruen came up with this idea.
Yeah, Gruen is a fascinating figure. He's a European, really socialist, who fled the Nazis, came to New York originally, and was both a kind of experimental theater kind of avant-garde intellectual, but also a shop window designer. And he would kind of design, you know, nice displays for department store windows. And then he had this vision of a kind of an interior space where shopping could happen that actually was originally designed to look like the old city centers of places like Vienna, where he had grown up. And so he built a number of them. The very first one was actually outside of Minneapolis, but they're in places that he built one in Detroit, outside of Detroit as well. And they, it's almost kind of this tragic story in a way, because they ended up being built outside of city centers, and they were one of the kind of factors that drove people away from the inner kind of dense pedestrian-driven areas of inner cities to the suburbs in the 50s and 60s and beyond. And so what he was trying to create a little mini Vienna, and he ended up contributing to kind of the hollowing out of the big cities that happened in the 60s and 70s.
It's quite a ride with Steven Johnson, Wonderland. The Washington Post puts it this way, a rare gem. Our illogical, enduring fascination with play remains one of life's great mysteries. That is precisely what makes the subject so fascinating and Wonderland such a compelling read. Thank you for joining us today, Steven.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.